there are three advisory bodies to the World Heritage Convention, and what I would really like your views on is how you would rate the performance of each one in terms of how they give advice to the committee.
It's hard to rate them in a linear scale of best, a little bit less good, worst, because in fact they're not all equal to begin with. They don't all start from the same base. They're organized in different ways. They have different capacities. And so I think you can assess what they're able to do, but you have to do it in the context of their setup. And maybe I'll just quickly go through the three. I've certainly been involved closely with two of them, the two cultural heritage ones, ICOMOS and ICROM, which work in very, very different ways. I won't talk about their mandate so much in terms of advice to the committee, but in terms of the way they work initially. ICOMOS is a very small NGO. It has worked very hard over time to try to establish a kind of consistent line in responding to the expectations of the committee and in terms of responding to review of nominations and in terms of responding to reactive monitoring situations. But inherently, because of the nature of ICOMOS, an NGO which may change its stripes every 3 years when there's a big election, has a great difficulty in maintaining or plowing that smooth furrow from generation to generation. The elected officers say, we are elected to run the show, and whether or not they have relevant experience with World Heritage, they often begin to interfere as soon as they're in their new seats. So you depend, you hope for the best, you depend on the goodwill of the newly elected officers, and you depend on their thinking, well, I'm new here, and perhaps I should find out a few things before I open my mouth and go off the deep end. But you can see quite often, that certain people, once elected in ICOMOS, gravitate to World Heritage because they like it, and they push themselves into the decision-making. Sometimes that can be positive, but quite often it's disruptive and breaks that line of continuity. I think, just to stay with ICOMOS a little bit longer, that in spite of, their inherent, institutional limitations, the big one is a lack of continuity. The other institutional limitation is really the fact that they're so small and don't really have the resources that I think would help them do the job they're expected to do. Nevertheless, in spite of all those limitations, when you look at how they performed going back 20-odd years, and that's the range of my experience with them, you can see, I think, very clearly that year by year, they've improved their ability to respond to the expectations of the committee. If you go back to an ICOMOS property evaluation carried out in, 1990 by Léon Pressuyer with ICOMOS, for ICOMOS, these are very, very short art historical analyses. They're quite elegant and quite beautiful to read as long as the building is somewhere in the pantheon of art historical monuments. But as soon as you move to something like the vernacular or the industrial or a city where a Pressuyer's, background and thinking was of less value, it's what's said is much less relevant. And at the time as well, when he would comment, he really would simply comment about values. He'd say very little about authenticity, very little about management. There were no missions carried out by ICOMOS at the time to vet conditions on site. So the focus was very, very limited. With time, and you can see progressively year by year, I won't go into details about who was involved, but you can see a slow improvement in the depth, the comprehensiveness of the ICOMOS response to nominations. And today, if you look at an ICOMOS evaluation, it's 10 to 12 pages long. It's not just a question of how many pages, but it now looks closely, differentiates between what the state party claims and what ICOMOS believes to be something it can live with. It also looks carefully at values and all the value-related questions, carefully at existing state of conservation and management issues, authenticity, integrity, and very carefully draws up a set of conclusions about should this go on the list, should it be referred or deferred, but with argumentation supporting that. The criteria proposed by the state party are examined very, very closely, And, you know, each one is sort of thumbs up or thumbs down, but there's a rationale provided. And sometimes the ECOMOS will say, well, actually, even though the state party didn't mention this, you know, we think that it would work best with this. Here's why. So there's a very, for me, a very strong and useful document, which is, you know, which links conclusions to rationale all the way through. And you can be aware, if you work a little bit with ECOMOS, that this is not the result of one person working with a file. There is a kind of review process that involves groups of people. You know, there is a World Heritage Working Group in ECOMOS, which tries to manage the process, but also talks about content quite often. And more specifically about content, there's something called the World Heritage Panel, which can be as many as 20 to 30 people reviewing what a particular advisor may propose as a way to treat a site. ECROM inherently has a quite different role, just because of its setup within the convention. It was a Johnny-come-lately cultural heritage body. It wasn't envisioned initially that there would be a need for a second cultural heritage body, but ECROM pushed in the early going. I understand that Gaël de Guichen, who was one of the strong staff members of ECROM, found his way into one of those early meetings and said, you know, you really need us because we're the training body. And once you have sites on a list, you're going to have to think about what comes later. And he was prescient. He was looking ahead. At the time, though, there was a lot of reluctance to accept a second body for cultural heritage. At any rate, ECROM is intergovernmental, just like UNESCO. So they behave in a very different way than ECOMOS. I think it was legitimate that ECOMOS as an NGO was given the task of carrying out neutral assessments of nominations coming from governments. ECOM doesn't get involved with that at all. But they have, over time, made themselves more and more available and more involved in the post-inscription questions that arise. How can we improve the management of sites? And they often find themselves responding to sites that get in trouble, sites on the danger list, sites where new issues arrive, saying, well, we could turn some of our energy and our money towards those problems. You know, we can see a common theme, and maybe we can make a program out of it directed regionally or thematically to something. And I think they now play quite a significant role in terms of assisting the committee to deal with the post-inscription issues. In 1999, they went from the only advisory body that had never been funded or received any funding support from the World Heritage Committee to they got on the dole as well. but from my point of view, when I was part of pushing for this, I think it helped make them more serious. This was not a one-way street in terms of spending. This was money to ensure participation of people in activities, which was not inside ECROM's budget. But ECROM itself began to devote significant amounts of its own money to the pursuit of these things. The best example, perhaps, is Africa 2009, a program intended to help 40-odd African countries improve the conditions for cultural heritage in those countries through training, through capacity building, which recognized the World Heritage Framework as a key framework for enlisting the interest of the governments, because everybody wants to be part of the World Heritage System, and through that, giving them a means to influence what went on in the name of cultural heritage conservation across a country. So we were trying very hard to identify emerging problems, emerging threats, emerging issues, which would benefit from a concentrated focus of expenditure or activity. As I say, sometimes on a regional basis, sometimes on a thematic basis, sometimes putting the two together. Even programs, for example, like ECROM's ITUC program, which is a program focused on, ITUC means Integrated Territorial and Urban Conservation, and that program was meant to assist decision makers in historic cities around the world. But that program, in the end, did much of the testing ground for that program was often World Heritage Cities. For me, the most impressive of the three advisory bodies, and maybe this is because I've never worked for them, seen things with rosy, in the rosiest light from afar, is IUCN, the World Conservation Union. They combine in some ways the qualities of an NGO because their membership formula permits individual professionals to be part of the organization, as it does governments. And they combine that with the strength of a strong institutional organization with a staff of 200 regional offices all around the world. They're kind of a mixed in terms of direction. You know, they're both a network and governments who invest large sums of money in support of the objectives of IUCN. They have a much larger staff than the World Heritage Center, much larger staff than ACROM, and are quite able with their worldwide networks, you know, to act quickly, effectively, and usefully. And they have a permanent little World Heritage set up inside IUCN. And so, again, this goal, which I think is important, of treating the issues with some consistency from year to year, they're very good at doing, because there are changes over time of personnel, but new people are brought in beside existing people before the older ones float away, and then you've got one voice, for the most part, carrying the message that they choose to express. So even though they come from the largest organization in terms of staff, the continuity is carried by that one very able person. And I think both ECROM and ICOMOS, even though they're much, much smaller, have somehow, for perhaps legitimate reasons, been less able to develop that one voice. And this is always, I think, something that hurts them.
While we're still talking about the advisory bodies, it might be useful to have your take on the global strategy of 1994, which actually started as a cultural framework and then got kind of picked up and considered to be both cultural and natural over time. I guess it's the question of the usefulness of the global strategy and the role that the advisory bodies, particularly the cultural ones, played in building that, and how effective you think that is.
Well, I think just to begin in a very general way, I think the global strategy was a very important innovative step forward. And when it was first articulated, perhaps in 1994, when there was a meeting which gave us the bones or the skeleton of a global strategy, I think that was that offered a major departure for the committee from previous ways of looking at heritage and perhaps even dealing with heritage. I don't think all of the opportunities that were put on the table by that meeting in 1994 have been realized. But nevertheless, there have been many benefits that have flowed out of taking perhaps misinterpreting some of the push that meeting came up with, and those benefits have had to do with mobilization of the different regions and managers and administrators and national authorities in the different regions around World Heritage issues. In the end, I think the global strategy, if you're going to assess it in terms of the numbers and the statistics, has it resulted in a more balanced and more representative World Heritage list because suddenly we're more aware? I think the answer is probably it didn't make any difference at all. But to go back to the beginning, I think one of the important things that the Global Strategy meeting offered, which has not really been picked up on as it might have been, is the move from a typology-focused list to a thematically-focused list. I think the results of the global strategy and the sort of little scheme of broad themes that proposed offered a big opportunity to move beyond the way the committee had been working for quite a period of time. The global strategy was preceded in my memory by efforts to define a global study, to carry out a global study, which was, I think, a kind of misguided effort on the part of the committee and on the part of the advisory bodies, who weren't sure quite of what they were trying to get at. But the global study was meant to establish a kind of geocultural template into which you could pop all the possible World Heritage nominations. If you could have a matrix that was big enough and comprehensive enough on the wall, then you could just take every new nomination and say, we don't have any of those, and we'd know right away what the answer should be. The problem with the early versions of the global study, and Henry Clear provided a couple of drafts, but other people were involved as well, is that they were highly Eurocentric, and they were perceived to be highly Eurocentric. The other thing that was missing is that implicitly this involved a focus on categories of heritage as opposed to thematic typologies into which heritage properties might fit. What do I mean by that? I meant that people looked at the question of new nominations in terms of how many of this type do we have? So if we had a new French cathedral coming along, a new nomination, we'd ask, well, how many of these French cathedrals do we already have? We have 6. Do we need more? Do we need 7? And you know, that's a superficial question, but that's where it would start. And then you'd say, okay, what are the qualities of the seven that might allow us to distinguish it from the first six? And if we're going to talk about outstanding universal value, can we actually make the claim that this has a different kind of outstanding universal value than something that's already there on the list? And the global study somehow accepted the idea that typologies were okay. Somehow those of us working with typologies were always dissatisfied with this discussion. You know, in reality, the answer to the question, how many French cathedrals is enough? There is no answer to that. You can't, there's no clear, objective, mathematical answer to that. And it's the wrong kind of question to ask. It's not a question of understanding what the typology should be and then asking what's the right number. It's a question really of backing up and recognizing what those typologies really express in terms of development on the planet. And the thematic framework offers an opportunity to say, what are the basic messages? What are the basic themes? What are the basic stories of human development on this planet that are important? You know, and to parse that question down into sub-themes and so on. And then looking at particular nominations that come forward and say, how well do those sites or those places support this theme? And once you work in a thematic framework, you're much more likely to come up with a range of inscriptions which encompass all of the major ways in which, you know, society has organized itself to produce conditions for living and development over time in the world. And it's a much more sophisticated way of looking at heritage. I suspect the Canadians and the Australians, who were part of the 1994 meeting, had a lot to do with this because they both are quite comfortable with this back home. So it may have edged onto the table with a little bit of help from some delegations. But I really think it offered a huge opportunity to, you know, change the way of thinking. And the committee adopted the report, you know, of the 1994 Global Strategy Meeting. And therefore, in my mind, it adopted that thematic framework, that very schematic, short little thematic framework. I don't think the committee as a whole really understood the difference. I think they saw this was a better way to go forward than what it did, what it, you know, had followed, which was the global study, you know, the effort to find a comprehensive, you know, matrix within which you could plant all civilizations and all forms of expression of those civilizations. They saw this as simplifying, clarifying, and energizing. But I think if they'd actually asked themselves, what are, you know, can we look at these themes? Can we look at them more closely? Can we elaborate on these in more detail and come up with something like Parce Canada's system plan, for example, but for the planet? Then I think it would have changed the way nominations come forward. I think it would have helped countries better understand what OUV is all about, because they could see, if they can see their place in the place of their site in aiding the expression of one of those important themes, then the link to OUV is quite clear. That didn't happen. And in some ways, it's just led to more confusion from time to time. I mean, ICOMOS did a big gap study at the request of the committee, which took them 3 or 4 years in the middle 2000s, 2003 to 2006 or something like that. They were involved with this. And their study talks about three different ways of assessing what's on the list. They refer to typologies, and they analyze everything in terms of typologies. They refer to themes. That's good, because it goes back to 1994. They also refer to chronology, as I remember, as another way of classifying sites. But they didn't, you know, ICOMOS didn't get it. You know, when you look closely at the theme part, which is the part that interested me most, when they came to sub-themes, the sub-themes were all the typologies. So they had, you know, they mixed up the apples and the oranges. And so their document really didn't offer any clarity or guidance, I think, to the committee. It sort of reflected the existing situation, but it didn't say, here's the way to go forward in it, because they didn't themselves really see what advantages a thematic approach might have offered. The big advantage of the global strategy, I think, has been, however, as I said at the very beginning, the idea that the World Heritage Center, with funds from the committee, funds from any source, would go out region by region and on a regular, repeating basis, engage the authorities and the site managers in workshops, asking them, just, you could call these training workshops or awareness building workshops, but asking them to think more clearly about what OUV might be like in a region. You know, what does OUV mean for you? What does authenticity mean? This might be very didactic. It's sort of going back to the core ideas inside the convention. For some, it might have been repetitive, but by putting people together to compare notes, you know, within a cultural group or within a cultural context, it really opened the door to recognizing cultural specificities in a region. It allowed the state's parties in to say, well, that part of it's for us. You know, we link to that. So it would either confirm or give them confidence in the directions they were going in or open up new doors for them. So they'd go back home with some new energy and some new thinking. They'd go back home also as part of a kind of World Heritage network. The World Heritage Center, who organized most of these workshops, would return on a fairly frequent basis, region by region. So there came to be a kind of expectation that, you know, World Heritage is not just we alone with our sites in a country, or, you know, myself alone as a manager, but, you know, you're part of something bigger. So it really energized many countries to think more about their sites and to think more about what they represented, maybe to extend that perhaps into thinking about how, now that we understand our sites and their OUV, can we better manage them? That's been very positive, and it's still there. You know, there's still every year a continuing round of these kinds of workshops.